The following is a encore presentation of the Donalana Kitchen.
Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgantas.
We gather here once a week at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames, Iowa. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. We are glad you have joined us around our kitchen table today. Donna, did you remember to set your clock ahead?
No, but if you use Apple, or maybe all the computers do this, your phone automatically does it. Your computer automatically does it. So I did have to run around and change a few clocks and things like that. But
well, my body does not automatically do it.
No, I'm going, oh, we lost an hour. Spring forward, fall back, that sort of thing.
It is getting on to be St. Patrick's Day again.
Coming around. Okay, and after that comes the equinox. Yay.
All this sort of stuff. Okay, we have a little bit of something from our archives here. Donna did a really good job of giving us a recipe for Irish soda bread. So let's hear this really good segment from the Donalana Kitchen Archives. We've got some Irish recipes to talk about.
Oh, yeah. So when I think Irish recipes, I have this wonderful book called The Forgotten Skills of Cooking. And this is by a chef called Darina Allen, D-A-R-I-N-A-A-L-L-E-N. And she is referred to as the Julia Child of Ireland, right? So this is a beautiful book. She's also a wonderful writer. She runs something in Ireland called the Ballymaloe Cooking School, which is one of those spots that all, you know, it's worth a pilgrimage to that I have always wanted to but never been able to do. But reading the book takes you quite there. So, I mean, and it's a heavy book. It's like 700 recipes, right? So I thought, well, how can I even begin this? So I thought, all right, I'm going to pick something that traditionally Americans eat, which is not, what's the potatoes and, was it brisket?
Cabbage. And
corned beef cabbage, right? Oh. I know, I wasn't going to do that one. But soda bread is something you will see, like right now, all the supermarkets in town have big displays of Irish cheeses and things like that. And what is the best thing to go with an Irish cheese or some really good butter? But an Irish soda bread. So I looked at her recipes and she has three or four in them with various, you know, stories about them and options and all of that sort of thing. So this morning I whipped one up. Now the nice thing about soda bread is it's really quick. I mean, I don't think it took me more than 7 minutes to mix the whole thing up. And then a half an hour in the oven.
Now, this doesn't have yeast, folks. You're not going through all that magic. No. It's really, think of biscuits, but because it has a little bit more care and kneading, it has a, it, it's
but not
nicer.
Much.
Not much, but not it, much. It's nicer. It's pretty.
Yeah. So she starts, I'm going to read a couple things that she says in here. Her first recipe is Mummy's Brown Soda Bread. In our household of 9 children, Mummy made this bread virtually every day of her life, well into her 80s. She always had a light hand at baking. Whenever we were, her bread was one of the things we looked forward to when we came home for a few days. She made many happy memories at the table. So then later in the book, she does several variations on the soda bread. The basic thing is that it has, she's calling it buttermilk. But she says a note about buttermilk, and I found this right interesting. In Ireland, shop-bought buttermilk tends to be very thin and low in fat, so mommy often added a little sour cream or a scraping of butter from a butter wrapper to enrich the bread. This results in a more crumbly texture. Often buttermilk is thicker and much more the consistency of yogurt. If using this kind of buttermilk, which is mostly what we have here, you'll need to use more of it than specified in this recipe. If the dough is too dry, the bread will be heavy and close textured. So she also says you can use other types of cow's milk and things and just to add a little souring, you know, or something like that. So I used the kefir that I always have going in my refrigerator. And it worked really, really well. And I made this version called the Spotted Dog Railway Cake.
Oh, that's nice.
Nice name, right? I just made it because of the name. I thought, okay. It's basically a version that has raisins in it, which you'll see a lot if you buy your soda bread. But here's the thing about soda bread. It is best eaten the day that it's baked. And I started it really early this morning and I just couldn't, I dove into it and had three pieces before I even thought about what I was doing. It was so good.
Thank you for saving some for me.
Yes, oh, right. Well, it's a full loaf, you know, but it's very good toasted. So, we did re-toast it up and I put a little surprise in it. So here's what she says. So you can use either whole wheat flour or pastry flour. And as she says in her book that white flour used to be more expensive. So it was considered a luxury to have white flour. These days, white flour is actually probably cheaper here anyway. So I used a mix of unbleached white and whole wheat. Pastry flour, not whole wheat bread flour, which you probably could use some in this, but it's basically 3.5 cups of flour and then 1 teaspoon of baking soda, because that's the leavening, and 1 teaspoon of salt, 2 teaspoons of sugar. So it's not really a sweet bread, okay? And then I put in quite a lot of raisins. I think I put, it says 2/3, but I probably put more. And then you mix all the dry ingredients and the fruit together just with your fingers, you know, till they're kind of well integrated. And then you, in another bowl, you mix 1 egg and 1 1/3 cups of buttermilk or kefir, right? So you mix the egg and the buttermilk, then you drop it into the bowl with the dry ingredients. You mix it with your fingers. She describes the, this mix well by lifting the flour and fruit up. Let's see. This adds more air. Then you put the egg in. Then you mix together using one hand with the fingers open and stiff. Mix in a full circle, drawing in the flour mixture from the sides of the bowl. Just like that.
Good.
The trick, she says, is to not over mix it. Do not handle the dough very much. Then once it's, you know, incorporated, it goes really fast. Really easy. Any fool could do this, I have to tell you. Then you spread a little flour out on the board. You dump the dough onto the floured board. Then you wash your hands and dry them so they won't continue to stick to the dough. And then you shape it into a round loaf. You really don't need it. You don't do anything. Then I did another little trick, which she suggested. Let's go back to mixing into the dry ingredients. Excuse me. This was the variation. Caraway seeds with raisins, right? Not sweetened. Now, I am not a huge lover of caraway seeds, especially, you know, you think rye bread immediately. But I thought, yeah, this sounds sort of interesting because here's what she wrote about. She calls this the variation, the American soda bread. Caraway seeds and raisins were added to soda bread in Ireland long ago, but the tradition went by the wayside. Not so in America, where soda bread often has caraway seeds and raisins in it. Usually when I go to the U.S., I take Irish recipes there, but I was delighted to bring this one back to Ireland. And then she says, you know, simply add 2 teaspoons, scant teaspoons, I might add, to the Spotted Dog Railway Cake, which is what I did. Now, the really nice thing about this is it's not enough caraway seeds that there's some in every bite. It's like you'll be eating along and you get the raisins, which you expect, and because you can see them. And then all of a sudden, there's this little note of caraway. What did you think about that, Lana?
I like caraway, and it was...
I made her guess what it was.
Oh, it was so good. And yes, the idea of having it slightly warm, you got to eat this all up right away. It's really good, and it is easy. I like making yeast bread too, but this is quick and good.
Now the other thing,
one more trick,
and this one is optional. I have a deep, well, Joe says it's called a chicken fryer, a very deep cast iron skillet that has a domed lid on it. So I bake the bread in that, which keeps, when you're baking bread in the oven, it actually keeps the moisture in. Mm-hmm. And so you throw it all in the oven at, I think you set the oven at 425 and then you turn it down to 400, and it's only a half an hour to bake this whole big loaf. It's really, really beautiful. Now, once you've got it in the pan ready to bake, you do this little thing, and I'm going to read from Dorina Allen one more time because this is really cute. Cut a deep cross into the bread. This is called blessing the bread. And then prick it at the center of each of the four sections to, quote, let the fairies out.
There you should.
Yeah. And the reason for that is, and that's, then it comes out baked with this cross in it. It's really quite attractive. And that is to, because it's a, you know, it's a soggy quick bread. That does help it cook more thoroughly through. So the other thing that she wrote about, I hope I haven't lost my place. What's that pot called? Bastable.
A bastable.
She talks about, on the next page after the soda bread, she talks about, I learned to cook over an open fire from my great aunt in Tipperary in the summer holidays throughout the 50s. All of the cooking was done in the big fireplace. She says that basically before the 1950s, most country homes did not have an oven. They all cooked on a wood fire. So a bastable is an iron pot, usually with three little legs underneath it and a slightly domed lid. This is what reminded me of my cast iron. So my cast iron skillet is not a bastable because it's... doesn't have the legs on it, right? Mm-hmm. But I just like the word bastable.
Isn't it nice?
It's a nice word. So something else very Irish, and I have to tell you, this bread is it's easier than making scones. It's easier than making biscuits. It's quick. It's also, unlike biscuits and scones, which require more either lard or butter or something, the Irish soda bread has very little, or, well, mine had none, just the fat from the kefir in it, which is not a lot. Now, our Irish soda bread recipe that is on the website is pretty similar. It has 4 cups of flour instead of 3.5. It's still a teaspoon of salt and 3 teaspoons of baking powder. Aha, different. Oh, mine had no baking powder, only a teaspoon of soda. Mm-hmm. Okay. A 1/4 cup of sugar Lana has here, but mine had much less, 2 tablespoons of sugar. This recipe has cardamom, but instead I put the caraway, and then 1 3/4 cups of milk and buttermilk and 1 egg and 1 cup of dried currants. So that is fairly similar. So you could try the recipe on our website if you are interested. Yeah. And it's a wonderful thing to make for breakfast because it's very quick and it makes the whole house smell really nice.
Ah,
your Irish breakfast.
There you go.
With lots of butter, or the picture in Dorina Allen's cookbook shows it with a big wedge of cheese.
That would be good too.
Yes.
So to find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen and to find our recipe page, you can go to khoifm.org. That takes you to this wonderful community radio station. Look for the talk shows. Look for the Donalana Kitchen. And we've got recipes there. And to keep in a theme here, I would like to play a bit of music, but this music starts out with a reading, an Irish poem by William Butler Yeats, and this is from a concert given by the Barn Owl Band many, many years ago, and the person reading this wonderful poem that leads into the wonderful music is Roger Alexander, a Barn Owl Band musician, and let's hear that this wonderful poem. It's called The Fiddler of Dooney.
When I play on my fiddle in Dooney, folk dance like a wave of the sea. My cousin was priest in Kilvarnet, my brother in Mochabui. I passed my brother and cousin. They read in their books of prayer. I read in my book of songs I bought at the Sligo Fair. When we come at the end of time to Peter sitting in state, he will smile on the three old spirits, but call me first through the gate. For the good are always the merry, save by an evil chance, and the merry love the fiddle, and the merry love to dance. And when the folk there spy me, they'll all come up to me with, "Here's the fiddler of Dooney," and dance like a wave of the sea.
Listening to KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. I have a poem to share with you by an Iowa author called Michael Carey. He writes Iowa poems, and this is from a collection called Nishnabotna. Nishnabotna is Iowa River, but he writes about an Irish immigrant that comes here to farm. And this poem is called Turlo, the Irish Tenor. It talks about his neighbor. Now, this is an Irish farmer farming in Iowa that, unfortunately, he couldn't sing very well, but that didn't stop him. Here's the poem. Turlo, the Irish Tenor. He was a lousy singer, but that didn't stop him from opening his mouth whenever he felt like it, and he felt like it constantly, and sharing his loud, lilting breath with the whole county. Every now and then there was a note I'd remember that seemed from a tune I could name, but then the air would swirl his sounds into gibberish. He worked so hard over the years, yet he never got better. Luckily, there's miles between houses, and I didn't mind if the cows didn't. He'd sing to them, and to the oats, and the sunflowers, and the alfalfa, and the corn, and all the animals grazing on the newly broken prairie. They, too, must have recognized something pure and fine in the wild currents moving wildly through his old and wrinkled body, for his farm was cleaner, his crops were greener than anyone's. And everywhere he went, everything he touched seemed to waken and turn its many beaming faces toward this mysterious voice of the heartfelt song. That's some thoughts on An Irish Farmer by Michael Carey, a poem from his book Nishnabotna. Also, here are some thoughts on St. Patrick's Day from our archives, taken from a Donalana Kitchen show recorded way back in March 2017. We talk about Irish roots, Irish thoughts, and Donna's got some cookbook advice in this bit of audio, too. Let's go to that. St. Patrick's Day is coming up. Speaking of immigrants, and we're all immigrants here, and there was a
bunch of folks that came over from Ireland. And this time of year, we think about St. Patrick's Day. We welcome into our studio to talk about Ireland and other things, Mary Swander. Welcome to our kitchen table, Mary Swander.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, so Mary's the poet laureate of Iowa. She's also the Iowa ambassador to, unofficial, of course, the cultural ambassador to Ireland, and she is of Irish descent quite clearly. So she's going to tell us all things Irish, and she's going to start by telling us about St. Patrick.
St. Patrick was a monk from England, and Ireland was, you know.
All those pagans, right?
Oh, right, all those pagans, and so they needed to be converted, of course. And so St. Patrick had a really interesting early history. He had actually been a slave and captured and all sorts of cool things. And so he came to Ireland, and wasn't the only one, but he was kind of the key person that converted the Irish to Catholicism. And the Irish were, always kind of had this pagan mentality, and so they were like...
They're Celts.
Yeah, so they were like, you know, they worshipped nature, and so they worshipped the rock over here and the sun, and they worshipped the wind, and so it was like, oh...
And the goddesses and the gods.
Yeah,
and
so they're like, Jesus Christ. Okay, so they...
There's
just a layer. They just, as Catholics were good at doing, they layered Catholicism on top of the pagan religion. So if you go there, the pagan religion is very much the underpinnings of the whole thing. And then they established monasteries, you know, all over the country. And their work was to transcribe, copy
manuscripts,
literature,
right?
Manuscripts.
This was before the printing press.
Yeah. And the Irish were such great storytellers that the story is they came toward the religion because the monks taught them to read and write. And they wanted to record their story. They didn't really, you know, whatever the trappings were, okay. But they really wanted
to tell your story too, right?
and so, you know, that's what was the big boost to their great literature tradition.
They were looking for a publisher.
And yes, wasn't that right. During the very, very dark ages in Europe when almost everything, all learning came to a standstill?
That
and
did.
So in the outer reaches of the Celts kind of held down the fort with reading and writing and made those manuscripts.
That's correct.
Kept it going. Some beautiful manuscripts.
Yeah, no, just gorgeous. And, you know, the Book of Kells is one of them, and that's in... Now in Dublin, that's a must-see if you're going to Ireland for the first time or just doing the highlights of it. That's one of those old ancient manuscripts.
Good. So tell us about your connection to Ireland.
Well, my mother's family is 100% Irish, and they came to this country in two different waves. One, famine Irish. My great-grandmother was born into the famine in 1845. Not a good year to be born in Ireland. And then, so they came, and then my grandfather came during the tumultuous, 1917 era.
And your grandfather was a doctor,
yeah,
right?
He was a doctor.
So we came to rural Iowa, an Irish Catholic doctor.
Yeah, and it wasn't easy because things were so divided up into ethnicities in those days, and there's so many prejudices that he could only have an Irish Catholic clientele. And so he had to. They basically.
What, we had so many doctors. You could pick and choose by the doctor's religion.
No, we didn't have that many doctors. But Protestants were forbidden to go to him for his services. And so, yeah. And so my grandparents actually chased around from town to town in southern Iowa because the Ku Klux Klan was after him, burned a cross on their yard, burned my grandfather out of his office. So it was, there was some high drama there.
Mm-hmm,
and then they,
I hate to say it, but my German ancestors in Illinois had
something to do with that.
But we're all good friends now.
Yeah. That's right. So it wasn't easy. And at the same time, he left Ireland the during that era, and the Black and Tans, which was a kind of a guerrilla group that the British organized, were after them there, and they were doing similar, maybe even worse things to my family on that. They were on the west coast of Ireland, and then before that, we had various famines and British colonialism, and we had. I actually went back. I've been going back for years, but I discovered our family farm.
Mary's one of the few immigrants in, the third generation or so that still knows her family in Ireland, knows the family history, has been to the family farm many, many times. I hope we're writing about this still.
We are.
Yeah. But we forgot to say Mary's a writer. Hello.
Yeah. And one of the things The family farm is right on the Atlantic Ocean, right on the ocean, on the west coast of Ireland in what's known as Connemara, which I had a archaeologist take me through the area at one time, and he said, okay, so here you are in your family farm, and this would be about the worst soil in
on the planet
on the no pretty, on the Cleggan Peninsula here and okay. And he said, and then the Cleggan Peninsula and the Argus Peninsula, that'd be about the worst soil in Connemara, which has the worst soil in all of Ireland. So that's kind of where we are.
So of course they wanted to come to Iowa.
Stood there on that farm and looked out into the ocean's most beautiful sight, but for generations they had families of 10 and 12 people living there on 80 acres, and there's maybe 10, 15 tillable. And tillable, that is not even a word to use there. The soil that is there is just rock. The soil that is there is decomposed seaweed that they haul
out
of the...
This is true on a lot of those Atlantic coastal areas.
Yep.
They haul up the seaweed.
Yep. And then they spread it over the rocks and let it decompose. And then, there wasn't a whole heck of a lot that would grow in there but potatoes. And then they had to farm and just kind of, to my view, kind of convoluted ways, contrary ways. It was hilly and rocky, for example, and they had to farm the potatoes in these big ridges.
The soil wasn't deep enough.
It wasn't exactly. Deep enough, and then it would, if you planted into that seaweed compost, it would just rot. There was no drainage. And then, on the farm, there's a hill, and they were going, you can still see the original potato ridge.
So how high is a potato ridge? Like 18 inches? Yeah. 24 inches?
Yeah, about 24 inches. And you could see it going straight up the hill, and I thought, well, that's just weird, because we would contour it around on a hill. And they were like, yeah, contour it around, right, Mary? And then it would just all pack down and hold the water in, and that's not what you want,
because it's no soil would just, to go down.
Right.
Into,
it would just bog down and become literally become a bog. So farming there is really difficult. I mean, one of the most moving conversations I had, I found this first cousin of my mother's, and she knew all the connections and all the relatives and who's married to whom and da 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 da. And she drew it all out for me.
So begot so and so.
Yeah, no, it was really great. And she drew it all out for me on a notebook. And then she said, we all lived out on that peninsula, but your family was really rich. And I was like, no, I don't think so. And she said, oh, they were really wealthy. And I said, no, not, I know this story pretty well, and they were not wealthy. She said, oh, they were. They had shoes. And that stopped me.
And she
said, and they had at least two meals a day, and they would bring us supper. And I'm like, okay, they were wealthy in those terms.
Well, I guess that's how your grandfather got to go to medical school.
No, he actually got to go to medical school. That's another story, because I had an uncle who owned the pub. And
That's how they got their money. Okay,
yeah, that's right. Right. And for a while, the pub did really pretty well, and four of the 10 children immigrated, and then there was another uncle that had a little bit of money, and they sent the two older boys, my grandfather to medical school, another to law school, and they got there, and then the pub went bust. And then they really had to immigrate. They went to Edinburgh first, mm-hmm. and then they were just stunk. They didn't have any money.
Do they graze sheep on that?
Now they do. Now, I mean, that's about all you can do.
Besides potatoes, what did they have animals? They must have what?
Yeah, they had. They lived on. I have a little diary entry of the 1800s, what their diet was. And it was breakfast, like a fourth of a potato. Lunch, dinner, the other fourth of the potato. And a little bit of piece of fish.
Oh, fish. Oh, thank
God. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
And then supper might be like a piece of bread, a little bit of butter, and some milk.
What were they making bread out of?
They said they were able to grow some grain. I can't remember what kind of grain it would be in that area, but they did grow some grain. And then, oddly enough, you'd think they'd all have rickets and everything. You'd think they'd all be really sickly. Well, they weren't. They thrived. They were actually really healthy. And
I suppose they could eat the seaweed too.
Was a big part of their diet. And they actually sent, there's an island, bunches of islands, clusters of islands off the coast there. And one of the islands that my family intermarried with is Inishbofin Island, which is the island of the white cow. So they have this whole mythology about the cow. Anyway, the government decided, this would be the Brits, of course, they decided, those people must be just, sickly and horrible over there on Inishbofin, and they're isolated, ignored, forgotten. The sea is very rough there, so it's not like you just
swim
back and forth. No. And so they sent a doctor over, and it was like in the 1880s, to write up a report about these wretched
poor people on the island.
People on Inishbofin. And because they were in the business of, the Brits were in the business of bringing them off the islands. You can imagine how well that went over for these people that had lived there for, centuries and centuries. So he was supposed to write up this report about these wretched, sickly people. And first he wrote up about their diet. Mutton, lamb, fish, dairy, seaweed. They had potatoes. And there would be like cabbage, a few other little vegetables. Mm-hmm. That was it. There was no heart disease. There was no cancer. There was no alcoholism. No mental illness, and nobody had any cavities.
Whoa!
On the entire island. So they were basically eating a diet that was, their physiology had become accustomed to it, or the diet fed their physiology. So they were, like, very, very healthy, so they left them. And now there are like 300 of them out there still. A lot of fun.
So things going on in Ireland, and Mary Swander is there to talk about it. About Ireland today.
And just to, by the way, if you want to cook some Irish food to go along with your Irish beer, let me remind you that Darina Allen, that's D-A-R-I-N-A-A-L-L-E-N, is the Julia Child of Ireland. And she has many, many good cookbooks out, The Irish Traditional Cooking, Forgotten Skills of Cooking, just grab a book and sit down and you will be transported. She's also, of course, a good storyteller in the book, as all Irish are. So if you want to immerse yourself in some Irish kinds of food, look for a Dorina Allen book from the Ballymaloe Cooking School.
This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You are listening to KHOI 89.1 FM. This is Community Radio for the Heart of Iowa, and Donna Lana Kitchen is Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. You can find out more about this fine show and this fine radio station at www.khoifm.org. You can go to the Talks Show section there, find the Donna Lana Kitchen, and we've got archives done, and you will never run out of things to listen to.
5 years of shows, once a week.
We've got shows that we talk about all kinds of food stuff and Central Iowa stuff. We have recipes there. The latest thing I think that was added was a real nice recipe called salted brown butter crispy treats. You remember the Rice Krispie bars? We got an update, a very cool update for that. It's an update. So you add your salted, you add your salt, and you add your browned butter to this concoction, and ooh, they are real, real good. So find out more at khoifm.org. And while you are at it, support this fine community radio station, because we get by with your donations. Thank you. So this is the time. We talked about spring. It's St. Patrick's Day time.
The wearing of the green.
It is.
Are you going to drink a little green beer?
No, I am not. I did that once in college, and I think that's a lot. Although I do like beer, I prefer my beer just kind of like as beer.
Did you ever dye your hair green for St. Patrick's Day?
No, I never did. Did you?
I did not, but I think my sister did.
See.
With the green food color.
I don't think I have any Irish roots at all, but that doesn't stop me from enjoying the music, the poems, the story. Irish writers are among the best.
Absolutely.
The music in their prose and poetry is just real fine. Also, this is the time for seeds and thinking of your garden. So kind of get out those seed catalogs and do some dreaming and do some planning. And I haven't done this yet, but I've talked to other people that are doing it. It's time for new chicks. So if your hen flock is getting a little long in the tooth, so they speak. Now, I think you're getting
some new chicks. And you keep your peepers right in the house, right?
Well, see, chicks start out really small, but they kind of grow fast. So I've got a place in my greenhouse that I keep chicks. In my experience, chicks are really cute for like the first 3 or 4 days. Oh, this little box of little peeping things. And then they start getting kind of
gawky,
and they start like smelling like chickens, and I don't want them in my house.
And do they eat your seedlings? How do you keep them out of your baby plants?
No. You don't just give them free. You don't put free range chicks in the greenhouse.
Okay.
No. They'll be in a little pen. It's kind of, you put up little cardboard barriers. They have their own little play space there, and I will do that. So think of ordering chicks. You can get chicks. Go to a feed store in the area. You can find those and get yourself some chicks.
Well, you could get some exotic ones. When I lived in California, I used to have, what are those ones with the top knots?
Oh, the Turkish crescent. Polish crescent.
Polish crescent. And they come in different colors. Oh. And so I would go to our local chicken buying place, and I'll have one of those and one of those and one of those. And, just because once they start to grow up and they run all over the backyard, they're it's just a collision of colors and styles and pecking orders, too, for that matter. But, yeah.
I think of chicks that, well, hens. A flock of hens is kind of like a movable flower bed. I mean, mm-hmm. the colors, and they're fun, and they are good company.
And there's those really curly-haired feathered ones.
Frizzy ones.
I mean, there's some incredibly interesting designs there.
Oh, yes, there are.
Right. They don't have to all be white leghorns or something like that. Yeah.
Well, some final thoughts about St. Patrick's Day. I asked our engineer, Evan Taylor, because someone asked me this question. I said, is Guinness, the traditional Irish beer, is that all brewed in Ireland, or is it like, you know, farmed out? And this is an important thing, and he told me.
Is Guinness Irish, yeah.
Guinness Stout is brewed at St. James Gate Brewery in Dublin, but there are some new iterations, such as their Blonde American Lager. It's Guinness Blonde American Lager. That's brewed at Dublin's Open Gate Brewery in Relay, Maryland. Maryland, huh? So they're expanding a little bit, but think of Guinness. And you have any more to say about
Well,
stuff?
I was wondering if they're going to have some Guinness at the Monkey Deck Pub. It seems they're good for parties. Going to drink a beer out of the Mucky Duck?
Plenty of things going on at the Mucky Duck. So, I mean, there are going to be St. Patrick's Day celebrations all over Ames.
Green beer all over town, right?
Green beer, great way to upset your stomach, in my opinion, but that you didn't hear that here. Anyway, so there is going to be a St. Patrick's Day celebration at the Mucky Duck Pub, underwriters of the show, of course, and that's going to be from 8 a.m. until 2 a.m., so it's going to turn into an all-day affair. And there will
on Sunday,
be
then.
Yes, on Sunday,
on
the actual day.
Yeah. Okay.
And they're going to have the traditional corned beef and cabbage. They're going to have some Irish poetry readings, Irish karaoke. I'm not quite sure what that means. I'm guessing a lot of Dropkick Murphys and other such sort of Boston punk bands, but maybe Irish songs, too.
Laura, Danny Boy.
Of course, lots of Danny Boy. Every iteration of Danny Boy there is. But there will also be music provided by Jin, Eric, and the Off-Brands. So that's Eric Timmons, Depay and Mitra, Ron Carson, who does our Pantorium sessions here and is in Burning Sensations, as well as Dean Erickson, who is going to be playing some keys. He's usually with Obsidian Stream. And, all sorts of fun happening out there.
So party on for St. Patrick's Day.
How fun. How fun. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We had music today by the Barn Owl Band playing some Irishy stuff, and we'll be going out with Julia Delaney and lots of other good stuff that they play. Support KHOI. If we are in your ears, put us in your heart, and think of opening your pocketbooks while you're at it. Go to khoifm.org. Support this fine station. Happy St. Patrick's Day. My name is Lana Nachtigall.
And I'm Donna Priskintos.
We've had fine engineering by Trey and Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life. Some thoughts on St. Patrick's Day and food from the Emerald Isle. Don has brought in an Irish cookbook and has been having a lot of fun talking about Irish food.
And here's another thing about St. Patrick's Day that we all need to know. It's the thing about corned beef and cabbage. It's not really a St. Patrick's Day dish. Yes, there's an Irish tie-in, but what we think of as corned beef is totally American. Did you know that? And it's a delightful cultural mashup. So this is the massively oversimplified Reader's Digest version of how the dish came to be. salted pork, think bacon, was popular in Ireland in the 18th and 19th centuries. When the Irish immigrants began arriving in New York in the 1840s, that pork was replaced by cured brisket from the kosher butchers.
Of course, kosher butchers would not have pork.
No! A more affordable cut that still tasted like the old country. Slowly cooked with cheap vegetables like potatoes and cabbage, a new national dish was born. For the Irish Americans, that is. So when you're having your beef brisket, don't be feeling so Irish. Be feeling American Irish.
Uh-huh.
That is what this is all about, after all.
Huh. Oh, here, I found this, too. The Brits invented the term corned beef in the 17th century to describe the corn-sized kernels of crystallized salt that was used to cure the meat.
Oh!
So it'll had lumps of... I was wondering about that. I wondered why corn. Why corn?
Corn, yeah.
Yeah, it was...
salt cured.
Yeah, salt cured. And they highly suggested using a concentrated pink curing salt. And that's why they're really
pink
good corned beef.
Pink salt. I wonder if that's like the pink salts that you see now.
Well, probably that you can get some. You can get pink looking salt.
Oh yeah, and salt, of course, was one of the first globally traded items.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So who knows?
Yeah, corned beef is a lovely thing. It goes well with. You often think of cabbage and. Actually, Cole Cannon, putting kale or some cabbage in with your potatoes and having that's a real Irishy sort of thing.
Well, wait, I want you also to mention, and this is not Irish particularly, what did you cook for dinner last night, Lana?
Oh, what did I cook for dinner? I had a squirrel. People look at me funny. I had a squirrel, and I remembered how to skin it when my husband brought me this squirrel, and it was good too. Although, and I found out from talking to my neighbor that hunts, I was wondering why it was so hard to skin. I don't remember him being so hard to skin, but he said that in the...
Is this an old squirrel?
No, not old. time of the year, end of a hard winter.
Their fur is sticking to their skin.
Well, yeah, not so much fat or whatever.
Oh.
I don't know. But anyway, the idea of skinning a squirrel, actually, I think you do this for rabbits, too. And if you have a squeezy stomach, don't listen to this part. But you take the little squirrel guy, and it helps a whole lot if... There's another person with another pair of hands because you use a sharp knife and cut around where its belt buckle would be and you work your fingers in there and you pull.
On the back or the belly side?
All the way around. Make a complete
uh-huh.
circle
uh-huh.
all the way around. And one person takes off the shirt. The other person takes off the pants. And you pull, uh-huh. pull. And it's rather inelegant, but that's with two people doing it, it's a really easy way. And then you can gut it after that.
Well, I need to learn because in my family, the skinning part was always done by the men. And though my son can skin and my father certainly could skin, I have been left out of this. And since I have neither of them around, that would make me helpless. I better learn to skin.
Well, one should learn these sort of things. And it's not like I was ever... You know, jumping into it a lot. It's just that I was, if I was handy, it was, get over here, Lana. Lend me your hand and we'll do
pull.
This together.
Yeah,
pull.
My mother always used to say, you know this old saying, there's more than one way to skin a cat.
Maybe that's it. Oh, dear.
Well, I suppose there's different methodologies for where to start. I mean, we could
say,
there's more than one way to skin a squirrel, but.
Probably. But that's how I learned. Once you get that going and undress the little fella, and actually,
did your mother used to say that? Is that an old saying in your family too? There's more than one way to skin a cat.
No, my mom didn't like cats.
Oh, well, even more reason to skin them. Mother used to always say that as a way of saying, you know, there are several ways to do this thing. You know, that means there's more than one way to skin a cat.
I like that term a lot, actually. So today is March 17th, and it is the National Day of Ireland, and it's the feast for the triple bearer of the triple key, the trident-bearing Celtic divinity assimilated into St. Patrick, whose sacred plant is the shamrock.
Okay, so we're talking about the pagan origins.
Yep, the pagan origins.
And with the Catholic overlay of St. Patrick.
Right. There was a Celtic divinity that had a shamrock. And
pre-Christian.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. And yesterday was a day to honor Dionysus, so grab yourself some wine. And on March 15th, remember, the Ides of March, that date was famous for the day on which Julius Caesar was assassinated.
Beware the Ides of March.
It's also the holy day of the Greek goddess Rhea, R-H-E-A, and it's traditionally a time to honor rivers, river sprites and nymphs. So this time of year, spring is
we're coming up on the equinox, which is always a major, you know, we've started into the Lenten fasting and all the pre-fertility approaching of spring and rabbits and eggs and birds and oh my.
Yes. Well, another springish things that are happening. What about seedlings? Is anybody else looking forward to gardening? I've been spending time in my little greenhouse planting things.
Little greenhouse.
Well,
Lana is serious. She provides seedlings for half the gardeners in Iowa.
No. I do seedlings for sale. And it's just, it is a fussy, lovely thing to do this time of year. And it's kind of nice to kind of get your ducks in a row and think about what you need. It is not too late to start potting or to start seeds this time of year. It's not time to put things out in the wilds of the outdoors yet, but
at least not in Iowa.
Not in Iowa, no. When you look to plant seeds, all sorts of good information is given to you on seed packets. And we have Google, and there's seed books, and you can talk to other gardeners. There's all kinds of advice, because folks, we're dealing with living systems here. Each little seed is a possibility for life there. So planting things early gives them a little jump in the greenhouse, and then things will be ready to go out after the last frost date. And in my neck of the woods, that's kind of mid-April. Although you can kind of push things and put things like onion seedlings out, and maybe some brassicas.
What are the more tolerant? The onions and the brassicas?
Yeah, and you can put brassicas and some herbs out, but I even if you put them out, you can put a row cover over it or something like that. But onions, believe it or not, are really tough, and you can put those little things in the ground. The first week of April, and then along about mid-April, you can kind of start watching your thermometer, and as soon as things the soil has to be a little warm out there. You don't want to go sticking things in a really cold soil.
Let me ask you, because I love to do nasturtiums, right, from seed, when should I put them in?
I would wait for nasturtiums until like the last part of April, because they're a hot weather thing. They like sun. They like warm. They like sunshine. So they're not really going to do anything until they have warm soil.
And I can put them straight into the ground. Then soak them overnight.
Yep, that's
and
great.
And then put them in. Although I have to say, I think the squirrels come and eat them.
Well, they look tasty to me. I bet I'd eat them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last year I did a thing. I put some bird netting over the pots where I was putting them in, and I did better with that. So.
Good idea. Oh, I have a little advice. And I've given this before about starting seeds. Well, first off, how deep to plant things. Just as a rule of thumb, if you have a big seed, like a nasturtium seed, that goes in pretty deep. If you have just a tiny,
now it's pretty deep. Half inch? Inch?
Think of it as about twice the size of the seed. So that's like quarter inch.
Oh, so not that deep. All right, so I'm probably planting mine too deep.
Yeah. You know, things like beans that you plant later. Big bean, it can go in the ground quite a ways, but we're talking about...
So twice the size of the seed is kind of the average...
It's kind of the average.
Rule of the thumb,
Rule of the gardener's thumb, yes. And if you notice, if you read advice on seed packets, sometimes it just says sprinkle teeny tiny salt
pepper-sized seeds on the surface and miss them. That's kind of tricky, but some seeds need a little light to germinate.
Oh, so, but it'll say on the
it
package.
Should say okay. On the seed. We can come to you live at noon here on KHOI. We spew. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Support this fine community radio station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
And excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.